The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Well, hello again. Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I am your host, John Schmidt. And again today, as every week, I'll be taking us out to the big picture, into the up close and personal, and toward a world of desirable futures, those, as you know, rich with the essence of constant renewal. Well, it is again radiantly bright here on the Gulf Coast of Florida. It is clear and it is beautiful. It is alive with a light and a stimulating breeze. And it is also day 55 of the Gulf oil spill here, over 7 weeks and potentially seven Exxon Valdez oil spills since the initial Deepwater Horizon explosion. In contrast to what I would say are the pristine images I'm looking at from my studio here on Sarasota Bay, the images from the other parts of Florida and from our adjoining states get even more stressful. I think the gravity of the situation ever more concerning, and the realities of what is really going on ever more shocking. And in addition to the environmental images, which I've really got to say that as a passionate lover of the ocean, simply rips my heart out daily, actually looking at many of these images. But over the weekend, I was struck also by some of the touchstones of where this disaster might be heading, especially regarding the financial and economic impact both here and on our adjoining states and the horizons. And two things came to me as I saw them this weekend. First, CNN was reporting that should this spill cycle further out of control, the impact on tourism on Florida, if only a 10% decline is actually experienced, all of that will result very likely in a $5 billion state revenue shortfall. That's on top of a budget deficit we're already working on. And the second is the University of Central Florida completed a study that shows that the Florida Gulf Coast could lose 195,000 jobs and $11 billion this year in deficit alone if tourism falls by half. Real estate's also vulnerable. We're concentrated in housing along the 8,400 miles of the shoreline, and we're already down a third or more from the recent financial crisis and the real estate bubble. As we connect the dots here, and we have been doing that on Zoomed, we continue to see the interplay and the interdependence of issues around energy, their connection to the environment, as we're seeing it here very locally, and to the relationship of our financial and economic system. The three E's, as we've been calling it, and that as a red thread, as our Danish colleagues would say, which builds and binds us together along the economic, social, and environmental lines. And maybe even adding insult to injury on this, with a system built on the need for growth, we saw on Friday that some of the leading economic indicators dropped from well above 50% to 47% or lower, which, as I understand it, and perhaps my guests can even speak to, has happened only perhaps 10 other times in history, and the response each time at a minimum included either a 20% equity market correction at one end or at a maximum a recession and a bear market. The issues, folks, we've been talking about are real. The importance of understanding these realities critical to our leadership lives, and perhaps all of that as an introduction and a stage setter today for our distinguished Zoomed guest, Eric Jansen. Eric is the founder and president of iTulip Inc., which is a financial analysis firm started as the website iTulip back in 98. Eric is widely recognized for more than a decade of his accurate forecasts and major economic and market trends, beginning with CNBC's Bill Griffith, who back in 99, if you hadn't heard it, you should know, he called iTulip.com the place to go for a contrary view of the markets. Eric's an executive. He's got the broad-based experience we love here on Zoomed. He's an author. He has 28 years of experience with high-tech startups, venture capital, finance, economics. He has widely interviewed and quoted by all the media that we talk about here frequently, CNBC, NPR, Wall Street Journal, Barron's, New York Times, all the above. He writes for many of these publications, including the Harvard Business Review and Harper's. And most importantly, or at least to our part of our conversation today, he has co-authored the book in 2006, The Bubble Economy, and has a forthcoming book for this fall, The Post-Catastrophe Economy. That's the focus and title of our show. Much more we can talk about, many other articles about Welcome to the False Recovery and to the next bubble, but a personal sense I was just describing to Eric as we were getting on, his analysis, his guidance, the writings from he and his colleagues have been instrumental to me personally through these challenging financial times, as well as to many of our colleagues on Zoomed, and I can't think of any other guest that, without knowing it, has been so influential on the Zoomed conversation and our focus here. Welcome, Eric. What a delight to have you on today.
Thank you, John, for the very generous introduction.
Well, thank you for coming on, and I think we got interrupted as we started the show. We were talking about the inception of iTulip. We were talking about the inception, sort of the passion and the inspiration. Maybe, Eric, maybe you can go back just for a minute to summarize that for our audience about how iTulip and you got connected to the flow of our conversation.
Sure, John. Happy to. iTulip started in 1998, back when I was doing research for a seed stage capital firm called Osborne Capital. I was the managing director. And my objective was to determine how to make our investment decisions. We'd put money into 20 companies, and we had six liquidity events, a couple IPOs, and sales to Microsoft and Nortel and Cisco and so forth. And my objective was to understand where we were in the cycle, and therefore when we ought to be selling our stock. And what I figured was that we were in a bubble and we ought to sell in the spring of 2000, which we did. And, you know, in the process of doing that research, I decided to share it on this website called iTulip, which, as you can tell by the name, is derived from the tulip mania. So if you remember at the time during the dot-com era, you put an I or an E in front of anything like pets, for example, and you had a company.
That's right.
So what we did is we put I in front of tulip, and we had the internet version of the 1630s Dutch tulipmania. And that was the idea behind the name. And the site was there and continues to be there to explore these ideas and understand what the underlying process is that's driving our economy. So our theory is if we understand the underlying process, then we have a pretty good chance of how things are going to turn out in the future. So that's our philosophy of forecasting.
And Eric, I think what's been so meaningful for me, it's not only just an understanding sort of a theoretical basis, and you and I were just talking about this before we got on, but there's the practical side of this that you really point to, and that is, what do we do with this, and how do we actually engage the world with the knowledge that we have? That's a really tangible piece of it.
Yeah, that's right. My background is as an executive in the high technology industry, so I practice what I refer to as practical economics. So what I want to know is, you know, how is this analysis useful in decision-making and in planning purposes? And the greatest difficulty I see over this past 10 years, and I also think going forward, is that there's been a substantial amount of economic volatility. And volatility is hard to manage through, but easier to manage through if you understand what the dynamics are and what's going on.
So maybe that's a good jump off. I was trying to set the stage and connect the dots a little bit, Eric, for where our conversation has been with our listeners here, but I think you've been really speaking to this very well about where we are and how we got here. Maybe we could start off with that, because I think you've got a good voice to that to help the understanding, but maybe help frame it in your language, where we are now and your sense of how we've gotten here.
Well, if you think back, I refer to what came to be known as the Great Recession, but it actually is a housing bubble recession, a post-housing bubble recession, is an extension or a continuation of the recession that we would have gotten back in 2001 if we had not reflated the economy through some fairly drastic measures, including those which resulted in the housing bubble, and a number of others, too. Private equity, for example. You might remember the flurry of big private equity deals that were heard up until the late part of 2007. And then that came to a grinding halt, too. So what we're in right now is a period when the destructive force of the collapse of those bubbles has been halted through some radical monetary and fiscal policy, and that did halt the process of economic contraction and the kept the financial crisis from spiraling out of control and spilling over into the real economy. So that was successful. We didn't get a repeat of the 1930s, but we do have an economy which remains somewhat distorted and in many ways not sustainable. And I believe that's what we're starting to see in the markets and also in some of these economic indicators, like the one you mentioned at the beginning of the show.
And Eric, I know we just got a short amount of time, maybe a minute or two here on this first segment, but say a little bit more, if you could, about the distortions as you might see it, given the flow of the public sector coming in so strongly with the fiscal and monetary policy. How is that actually playing out?
Well, there was a very pointed analysis done by Goldman Sachs in April of 2008, which noted that by about this time, that the fiscal policy that was put in place in early 2009 would begin to exert a negative impact on the economy. And that might be unintuitive, but the reason is that all this public spending, all the public credit that's been expanded to compensate for the decline of private credit, begins to crowd out private credit. So it really slows the process of economic recovery in the long term, although in the short term it provides a necessary cushion to stop the destructive process that was in train.
And so I think that you're starting to paint the picture here. And as I was reading something even on the site with one of your interviews, I was struck by the words that reflate and wait, kind of as a process. Is that language appropriate to what you're describing here, or is that on some other, the further topic about some of the European issue that we were talking about?
No, that certainly applies to us. The theory is based on this idea of the Keynesian multiplier, which is that you spend a bunch of government money and it produces more economic surplus than it costs. That's the theory of the Keynesian multiplier. And some people believe in this theory. I don't happen to. I think it's the economic equivalent of a perpetual motion machine. I think that there's intuitively there's a cost to borrowing money and using it to reflate an economy. And so what we're going to see is, what's happened is we've moved private debt to public account, both literally in the terms of our central bank purchasing non-marketable and bad debt and putting it on its balance sheet, but also through the process of using government spending to pay for jobs and those incomes, pay down private debts, and all the way down the line, this movement of private credit to public account will start to go in the other direction. In other words, you have to move it back again. And the way that typically happens is through the process of taxation. And so the inevitable outcome of these asset bubbles is financial crisis followed by reflation policy, followed by a withdrawal of that policy and a reversal.
So, Eric, let's pick up on that. I hear the music that came in a little unexpectedly on there, and I think it might have even blanked out a little bit here. But let's pick up, because I think this reflate and wait and what that's actually causing and what actually might be the expectation, certainly a good place to pick up and where we're going. But where are we? How did we get here? Implications for the future? That's part of our conversation here on Zoom. Come back in a moment. Short break. Eric Jansen, our guest. Thanks.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind. There's a course offered on Seventh Wave Network that you never saw offered in college. One that provides information on how to transform ancient wisdom teachings into everyday life. You'll learn how to create from your spirit and explore the world with all of your senses. Participation is encouraged. Enroll in Spirituality 101, the course you can't afford to miss, with your host, Reverend Norma. Classes in session every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time, in your favorite classroom, Seventh Wave Network.
It's all Arizona, all over the world. If you're a local Arizona high school sports fan, or if you're a transplanted fan somewhere else in the world, have we got a show for you. The first internet sports radio talk show focusing solely on high school sports is The Coach's Corner with Scott Lovely. Tune in to talk about your favorite teams, players, or coaches. It's 100% Arizona high school sports coverage and a little bit more. Tune in Mondays at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern, to the Voice America Sports Channel.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back on Zoomed, another Monday, the focus of our conversation, the post-catastrophe economy. We have the backdrop of energy, the economy, the environment, as we have been talking about. Our guest, Eric Jansen, founder and president of iTulip, Inc., and iTulip, the website that most of you, if you don't know about it, you need to begin to go there. But Eric, I was just, we were leaving, last time I was really suggesting, or at least the language I was putting to it, the reflate and wait, and you were talking about the taxation and the impact of that. Maybe you can pick up a little bit more.
Sure. So the theory of reflate and wait is the process that has worked in previous recessions, if you think back to, say, 1990 and also in 2001. It seemed to work that we created a self-reinforcing economic growth through a combination of fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus. But this time, here we are at pretty much zero interest rates, and there's a tremendous amount of debt that needs to be rolled over, so there really isn't an opportunity to raise those rates. So what that leaves is this fiscal policy. We'd like to begin to draw it down, all the government spending. Unfortunately, a substantial amount of the economic growth continues to be dependent on that spending. So, and as long as that spending is in place, it has the tendency to crowd out private credit and growth in the private credit markets and the recovery of our commercial banking system. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, reflate and wait simply isn't going to work this time, and we have to find not, we can't just patch the economy. We have a big old pothole, and the patch is starting to wear out. What we really need to do is give it a good resurfacing and do it the right way and fundamentally address the structural problem that we have in our economy.
So as we head for that, Eric, I was suggesting in the opening comments the Gulf and the Gulf crisis and the interface of all this. Are there aspects of this that does that really, you know, bring that, does that really play into it as well in this sort of fixed dilemma that we're in?
Well, one of our structural problems is that we've become a net energy importer, particularly a net oil importer. The majority of it is coming from Canada, but also, of course, from the Middle East and other countries. And because we have consumed over the last 100 years all of the easily accessible oil, we are now in the process of applying more and more rarefied technologies to get after more and more difficultly accessed oil, for example, in deep water. And we have become somewhat entitled about the ability of all these new technologies to find more oil for us. And because the technology is so good and the energy exploration production companies have gotten so efficient at getting this oil for us at reasonable prices that we think this can go on forever, one of the things that's going to happen is we're going to have more and more accidents, such as the tragedy that we're currently working through, because that's unfortunately where the oil is now. We've consumed the oil that is more safely extracted, and this is the challenge that we have. In fact, the number of deep sea oil rigs is going to increase sixfold over the next 2 years, and that means there's going to be a lot more drilling. And just in terms of simple probabilities, the likelihood of another accident is going to increase. So the only solution is to reduce our consumption of oil. There really is no other way around it. There's no pools of oil on shore that we can get to substitute for this offshore oil. The only thing we can do is reduce our oil consumption, and that's what we have to focus on.
And from an alternative energy standpoint and from an investment standpoint, is that a place that can accommodate this, and can that be accommodated with the kind of investment and the reflate and wait dilemma that we're in now? How does that actually occur then, Eric?
Well, the truth is that this crisis, this evolving energy crisis, which we're just beginning to see the leading edge of, with that price in oil, that price spike in oil to $147 back in 2008, mm-hmm. that actually plays to our strengths as a country. We are the great innovators, so we are the country that is most likely to develop the kinds of technologies that are needed to both avoid new crises, but also to get the low hanging fruit, which is energy reduction, energy consumption reduction. And in my book, I talk about a couple of examples that readers can latch on to. One, for example, is the adoption of the use of light-emitting diodes for lighting instead of what we currently use, which is incandescent light bulbs, to reduce our fixed energy consumption, which is primarily used electricity demand. Mm-hmm. And a great deal of that is used for lighting, and a lot of it is wasted. There's a company that I interviewed for the book called Luminous Technologies, and they make a next-generation LED. And it's almost hard to believe that we continue to use incandescent light bulbs. You might remember when we were youngsters, we had these things called vacuum tubes. Remember those things?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Those little heaters.
Certainly dating myself, but yes.
Yes, they did the job. They just used a tremendous amount of electricity, and they weren't solid state. In other words, you couldn't really bash them around. They'd stop working. Transistors, of course, replaced them. But we haven't gone through that transition incredibly with light bulbs. We still have essentially tube light bulbs when they should be solid state. They should be made out of silicon-based material. So that's what LEDs are. They are the equivalent of transistors for lighting. And there'll be this transition that began actually a number of years ago. You can start to see them in cars. Most cars, their lightings, taillights are now LEDs. And you will start to see them over time work their way into many kinds of fixtures. And within, I would say, 5 to 10 years, you won't see any incandescent lights at all. And so these next-generation lights have two main benefits. One is they use about 95% less energy, which is a big savings, obviously, over an incandescent light, and probably about 30% even over fluorescence. But more importantly, they last virtually forever. A typical bulb has a life of about 100,000 hours, which is about 20 years. So they're extremely efficient, and they're very good for the environment because you're not constantly throwing materials away. So this is the kind of an American technology, and this is the kind of technology that we're good at developing and will get us out of this mess.
And so what about the other side? That's the electricity side of the demand. What about the transport side of the demand that has been that is so dependent upon oil and the nature of the extraction that we're experiencing in deep water and ultra deep water that you're pointing to? What about that side? I mean, are there technologies that you're suggesting at the same time that are emerging in that realm too, Eric?
Certainly. Our vehicles are still wildly inefficient, and they are inefficient because oil is still too cheap. And so there isn't the motivation to improve their efficiency, particularly not in this country. Most other countries have begun to gradually raise the price of oil through taxation over periods of decades. And if you do it slowly enough, the economy will adapt to the higher-priced energy. The automobiles and vehicles and trucks will become more efficient. What's bad is if it happens as a shock and it happens suddenly, and then you get the kind of effect that we had back during the oil crisis, the OPEC crisis in the 1970s. But if prices rise gradually, then the markets will adjust and adapt to it, and consumers will begin to demand automobiles that are much more efficient, and it won't be very painful. We'll simply continue over time to decrease our consumption of oil.
And what about the arena of shocks then, Eric? I mean, we've been having some conversation. We've had Richard Heinberg on in some time past, a few months back, that was talking about the nature of peak oil and the nature of the evolving situation, and some alluding to even the administration talking about the undulating higher-level plateaus and potential spikes. What about that? Are there anticipations of spikes and shocks that we might see, and how would that play back to your description of the economy and where we are kind of in this fix of this reflate and wait?
Well, this will be one of the complicating dynamics through this process that I call the transitional economy. The undulating plateau, of course, refers to a period of time when we continue to find oil, but not as, but only as quickly as we're depleting existing sources. And then on the other end of that plateau, there's a continuous decline in global oil production. But through this, there's a lot of debate about what happens in that period when we are approaching the peak. And my belief is we're going to go through what I refer to as the peak cheap oil cycle. Peak cheap oil meaning there will always be oil. The peak is in the availability of inexpensively acquired oil. And I believe we already reached that, and that we're on this plateau. And so the cycle is a result of the spikes in oil prices, which acts like a giant tax on the economy and slows it down. And if it's a very sharp rise, it will produce a recession. And the recession, of course, will cut demand. Demand will, when it declines, will cut price. And so we'll go through this cycle of what I call the peak cheap oil cycle.
And so that peak cheap oil cycle, Eric, I want to bring back to the nature of the post-catastrophe economy and the debt and the issues we have on that. I hear the music in our ears here, so let's take a short break, come back as soon as we can. Very valuable discussion.
Let's pick it up. Eric Jansen, our guest, come back on Zoomed in just a moment. Thanks.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
Wasting time. Get what you want. Live your dream life. The Dream Big Revolution. Imagine having more freedom, better health, more money, happiness. Could your business be more successful? Unless you're living the life you want, you're wasting precious time. Your life is too valuable to waste. Let Leanne Hilgers help you find health, wealth, and happiness. Listen in and live your dream life. Join the Dream Big Revolution. Tune in every Tuesday at noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time on the Seventh Wave Network. These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's AVASTONE consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back again, Eric Jansen, our guest. We're really talking about the post-catastrophe economy, many of the themes we've been talking about, but I think looking at the implications here, perhaps even in a more rich way. And Eric, we were just talking about the peak cheap oil cycle. Maybe we can bridge back into that and the implications of that, and then build on the where does that actually leave us and what can we anticipate?
Well, the primary challenge of this cycle of oil prices and recessions is that managing through it, it will be obviously quite difficult because it would be hard to plan over the long term for energy prices as an input to, say, food production or for businesses that are companies that are in that industry. But just overall, if you're trying to make decisions about payroll and planning for headcount, there's going to be this tendency to, for example, to avoid hiring full-time employees and to focus more on part-time to avoid the stresses of laying off and then rehiring full-time employees. So there'll be some changes in the way, I believe, in the way companies operate through this process because of the economic volatility that it implies.
So you're really pointing to that the net effect of this could be the environment going forward that's very volatile. It's less certain. I was using the word in during break, VUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. But that's really what I hear you suggesting about this peak cheap oil cycle.
Yes, because that's a good analogy, because in addition to the economic volatility, there'll also be geopolitical volatility. There'll be quite a contest for these resources, and it will stress the political relationships that the U.S. has. And as you were mentioning before, the U.S., of course, is a net debtor, not a creditor nation, and has to and counts on foreign debt for a good portion of its buffer, particularly in times when we're in recession. This is when our net capital inflows tend to reverse, and then we get into some trouble. So this is the this will tend to exaggerate these cycles and make them make the volatility even more difficult to manage through.
And Eric, as you were talking during the break, this peak cheap oil cycle sounds like it's moving, in your words, from considering the world as emerging versus the industrial portions of the world, that it really shifts more to energy importing, energy exporting in relation to that. Can you say a little bit more about that and pick up some more here about the implications on that on the financial side, especially in the relation to shocks and what kind of capacity we have to even withstand the kind of shocks that might be coming with lots of debts and a deficit that's pretty significant?
Well, one of my suggestions that I make in the book is that we can insulate ourselves somewhat from this environment by using this necessity of reducing our energy use and use that as a something to coalesce ourselves politically to focus on the problem and create a really view it as a national project to come out of this process as the most competitive nation on earth in terms of energy consumption, because it will turn out to be one of the most important competitive advantages is to not rely heavily on, particularly on oil for transportation. So viewing this as a necessity to be globally competitive, then we can think about how we might want to finance this. Now, since we don't really have the credit that we had before to go borrow all the money that we need to finance projects to reduce our energy consumption, what we can do is put together, and I spent some time in the book talking about public-private partnerships that will provide the discipline of the private market, yet the risk management capability of government in managing the risk of very large, very long-term projects, and put those together to build, for example, a new nuclear industry. And not like the old one that we abandoned, but a completely new and distinctly American nuclear energy industry that is safe and scalable and extremely efficient.
So it sounds like what you're describing is it starts with the perspective, a national project, a vision of something possible here and the importance of energy reduction, but then mobilizes that through additional new thought about public-private financing, different ways to get there. And it feels like that's kind of the rubber hits the road on how we actually can make that happen. It feels like that's an underpinning to it, Eric.
Well, yes. I mean, my background, again, as an executive, so I'm used to thinking in terms of what's possible, not what's theoretical. So if we don't have the money to finance these projects, we're not going to do them, so we have to go get it. We already have a substantial amount of outstanding Treasury debt, and a lot of that, a substantial amount of that is going to be rolling over because it's relatively short-term. About a quarter of it is short-term. It gets rolled over every couple of years. In order to maintain the current levels of foreign investment, we need to provide other instruments that allow our creditors to invest in our projects to improve our efficiency. So perhaps some sort of infrastructure bonds that sovereign wealth funds in China could buy, for example, and that these would allow, and that these projects would be pursued on a return on investment basis, not on this theoretical Keynesian multiplier idea, but simply on the idea that if you build a more efficient electricity system, for example, it is going to enable all the corporations and private enterprises that use it to themselves be more efficient and improve their productivity. And the productivity, of course, immediately translates into wealth creation. And that's what it's all about.
Well, you're actually stimulating in me that this is an amazing concept here to even put this in the terms of globally competitive in terms of our energy consumption. Seems to me that feels like a reframing in some ways, Eric, that provides a view of possibility and underpinned by reality. Where is this in the conversation and the potentiality? I know on Zoom we talk a lot about the need to bridge, as you're describing, public and private partnerships, but really bridging public, private, civil society, trying to build something that has a better understanding of the interdependence, the importance of that. What's the reality of it? Where is this now, and what's your sense about how to make this happen?
Well, it's not going to happen without a social contract that allows politicians, allows our legislature, allows our executive branch to make some decisions which in the short term may be painful, may be experienced as a decrease in living standards, but in the long term will produce a real boom to our economy. The last time we did that was back in the early 1980s when we had very high inflation, and it was the last time that we really had a political consensus in this country to do something politically painful in the short term that had a very beneficial long-term outcome. And that was raising interest rates to high double digits and putting the economy through a couple of tough recessions. And we boomed for 20 years after that. But there we had a clear and present problem. We had an inflation spiral going out of control, and it didn't matter what your political orientation was. Everyone understood that if we didn't stop that, it was going to be a disaster. The problem today is that we have many different factions with different interpretations of what the problem is, and no overriding mission that everyone can understand is in everyone's interest to pursue. And I think that this coming energy crisis will be is an opportunity to get everyone focused on solving an American problem.
And I like the real sense of innovation in that relative to the financing side of it. And does this include, Eric, the pain that would be involved in bringing the deficit down at the same time? Is that part of the experience of what we need to live through in light of the larger potentiality of the innovation around energy reduction and the competitiveness that we create there? Is that part of the puzzle in your sense?
Well, here we have Paul Volcker suggesting that we create a value-added tax here in the U.S. and use that to substitute for income taxes and other taxes to consolidate a whole range of complicated tax code into a tax which has the effect of reducing consumption and increasing savings. And that is a classic way to reduce debts. Government debt, and that has been successfully pursued in New Zealand and in other economies over the years, and that's what we're going to need to do. The trouble with the value-added tax, of course, is that it's regressive, and it will tend to impact lower-income families and households more than wealthier households. Mm-hmm. And so there will be some necessity in compensating for that. If you think about it, the fact that there are 40 million Americans on food stamps right now, that is a symptom of a policy where energy prices are feeding into food prices, and it hits the poorer households in the pocketbook first.
Yes, yes. So there are many, many dimensions to look at this problem from various points of the stadium or from the arena, different pictures of this. Eric, I hear the music in the background here. Let's take a short break. I want to optimize our time in the last segment. I think this is a very rich conversation, has both the view of possibility, the innovation, and the practicality. Let's take a break here, folks. Come back last segment with Eric in just a moment.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
The Marsh Engel Show. Join the movement to empower yourself with the essentials of feminine power and success and learn how women around the world are becoming more inspired, more influential, and absolutely amazing. Each week, Marsh sits down for an engaging conversation with women who are boldly committed to living their most amazing life. You'll discover ways to step into your greatest vision, deepen your relationships, and unleash your real creative brilliance. Get ready. It's time to jump into the conversation. That's Monday afternoons at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern for the Marsh Engel Show on the Voice America Business Network.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoom Leadership.
Okay, back on Zoom Leadership here today. Let me make sure that you really know how to follow up here. www.itulip.com. That will get you to iTulip, the website. I think you'll see it there. I think you'll get a first-hand look just getting on the site. Almost 12 million visitors actually coming into the site since its inception, and we can see why here with Eric's conversation today. Not only the writing, but the clarity that we have of both the positive side of the vision. Eric, you're really pointing to the playing to strengths here as a nation. Maybe we can pick up that and make that tangible in the last segment. But you're really doing that and pointing to what we have been good at, and that is inventing and the technology and the capacity to do things new and fresh.
Yeah, it's we're not a nation of bankers and real estate speculators. We're really a nation of problem solvers. That's what we do. You know, we may not be the most artistic and have the most the deepest cultural history, but we are the guys who get stuff fixed and move ahead to the next problem. That's what we do. So the thing that these projects, these major projects, will fuel and energize is that innate quality of us as a people and, you know, our innovation engine. And we are unusual, and this is the industry I come from, in that we have the whole end-to-end solution to solving problems. We have everything from the great universities that train the best engineers in the world, to the venture capital and private equity and financing and the capital markets that allow entrepreneurs to realize their dream. And that's most countries don't have that. So, and we have the tradition of intellectual property protection and property rights and all that that's necessary to make that whole process work. So we can engage that capacity with these by addressing this energy challenge. And these large-scale projects will create demand for all kinds of new technologies. So I'll give you an example. If we're going to build a new energy industry in this country, we're not going to build old Westinghouse nukes like the French have for the last 30 or 40 years. It'll be next-generation pebble-bed nukes, and that will require, for example, special ceramic materials for turbines that operate at very high temperatures, and that will all need to be invented, and so that will spawn a whole bunch of companies to go compete to solve that problem. And so this is this idea of building these falling these big projects is an idea of a way of engaging our unique strengths as a country. Then these inventions, of course, will need to be exported to other countries, and that will improve our trade position and help other countries improve their energy efficiency too.
So we have and I think we're good at project orientation and build up and making that happen. And I really like the end-to-end notion of the capacities we have here to make this happen. How do we mobilize this in a wide-scale basis? What's your sense of that? You've really spoken to Volcker and what might happen with the value-added tax, plus and minuses of that. But how might this get on the radar from a tangible way, Eric, to really have people beginning to get a sense of the possibility and the commitment as well as what we've got to do to get there?
Well, I think one of the first things that happened is that the dialogue will have to change. And currently, it's our dialogue on solving any kind of problem from healthcare, as a perfect example, isn't still not very constructive in this country. And people from other countries watch us have these discussions, and they're flabbergasted at the poor quality of the discussion that we have. So the first thing we need to do is understand that we're all trying to solve a problem that applies to all of us. It's harder to do with healthcare than it is with energy. So I think the forcing function here for political alignment will be the shared experience of all of us as Americans of what's going to happen when energy prices rise, and we're not prepared. I think that that's going to coalesce us to solve the problem. But I'm not sure that there's going to be a lot of reason to believe that there is going to be a coherent and thoughtful discussion until it becomes very necessary.
Do you think that this the Gulf oil situation could be an impetus that could be levered, or does it get caught up in the politics of just using this for political gain or advantage? I mean, is there potential there, or will this have to come to a shock to America that will be wake up to everyone?
Well, I think the way that the BP oil disaster has been covered is actually not that encouraging, right? Because here we have, first of all, a personal tragedy. A number of people died, and the political involvement has not been terrifically constructive. We have an oil company that's doing its level best to get oil out of the ground for us, just like Exxon and others. And rather than having a discussion about how we do it more safely and in the future, there's been a lot of pointing fingers at who's to blame and so forth. So my concern about is that we'll see. Well, we'll see how the discussion goes. If it eventually evolves into a more thoughtful discussion about whose fault it really is, and I would say it's all of our fault because we're the ones using the oil. We're the ones asking them to go get it.
Right.
If we finally get to that point of the discussion, then I'll be very encouraged because then we're starting to ask the right question, which is, okay, well, if these are the risks involved that we are incurring by using as much oil as we do, then clearly the objective is to use less oil. Mm-hmm. And how do we do that? And then now we're asking the right question.
Yes. And so, Erica, we're kind of winding in the last minute or two here on where we are in Zoom. bringing this down to a personal basis, I mean, there's a sense we're always talking about here on Zoom about our own leadership and how we exercise in that in our own organizations in whatever way and take it to the level of impact here. In this world of volatility, as you're describing, in this peak cheap oil realm, and with your describing, what suggestions might you have for our listeners about actually engaging and leveraging their leadership into this realm?
Well, I've run two startup companies. They're early stage venture-backed technology companies. And when you're a small technology company, the world is volatile. You're in an early market. You're not sure what's going to happen. And so you grow accustomed to managing through a great deal of change. And what I think is going to happen is even if you're running a pretty large company, that is how you're going to have to think about it. And your team and your process of decision-making is going to be based on much more volatility than we've seen in the past. Everyone will be a startup. Let's put it that way.
That's a great way to phrase it, Eric. Everybody's going to be a startup. Everybody needs to have that kind of resilience to be flexible, to be adaptive. You can start to hear the music winding down. Eric, I got to say, just from a personal standpoint, what a pleasure to have you on here to open this conversation, take it forward, give us a glimpse of your new book and where this is going to go. I hope we can continue this conversation, bring you back again, but what a delight to have you on today. Great insights for us.
My pleasure, John. Anytime.
Okay, great. Thank you. And Zoom guest, the conversation continues. I think what Eric has brought today is a picture of the innovation, of the potential, the positive view of the future, and the realities that underpin it. And we can't lose sight of what actually is going on. It's the mix of those. I think we started to point to the world that we've been talking about, VUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous. And it is our leadership, our own consciousness, our own action as part of that process. Join us next week as we continue this. Again, Eric, thank you so much for joining us. Zoomed out here, and have a great week. Enjoy and bring the images of clear beaches to your mind all week, if nothing else. Thanks.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel, and have a terrific week.